This is the Remote Podcast, and I'm your host, Victor Kung. You're listening to episode 24. Hello, and welcome to the Remote Podcast, episode 24. This podcast is all about location independence, digital nomadism, and living life on your terms. Each week, we interview a new guest on the show, and this week I sat down with Nathan Morgan, an SEO specialist and remote worker who has been living in Chiang Mai for the past 3 months. He's also a fellow participant on the Remote Trip program. In this week's episode, Nathan shares his story on becoming a digital nomad, and he talks about his realization that he didn't want to work for someone else, his experiences running his first business, and his experiences living in Chiang Mai so far. So let's get started. Hey, Nathan, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me today.
Hi, Victor. Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, I'm really excited to finally have the chance to interview you. Since the first time we met a few weeks ago, we just had good conversations, and that's what I always enjoy the most, having great in-depth conversations with other people. And so I hope you feel the same way about me.
Yeah, no, it's been great to meet you, and yeah, it's been a pleasure.
So to introduce you to my listeners, Nathan Morgan is an SEO specialist and a remote worker who has been living in Chiang Mai for the past 3 months. And he's also a fellow participant on the Remote Trip program. So we are going to be traveling together for the next 6 months, and we're going to be in a different city each month.
Yep, that's generally the plan. And yep, Chiang Mai, 3 months. And that was actually my first trip that 3 months ago. My first remote trip, even though I've been pretty much had the ability to do that for a long time, but it was the first time I took the plunge.
Yeah, so we're both relatively new to the idea of digital nomadism, but I wanted to start off from the very beginning, because from our previous conversations, it seemed like you really made an intentional transition to the digital nomad location-dependent lifestyle. So could you start the story from the very beginning to, let's start with college, what you decided to do after graduating, and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, it's actually pretty varied, even from college itself. So I started out doing forensic science, mm-hmm. which really isn't an obvious choice for someone who wants to live this lifestyle. But yeah, that's how I got started. I chose it because it was a fairly open-ended degree, and I found it very interesting. I think that's always been a central theme to the things I've chosen, is I've always wanted to pursue my interests. And I left university not really having a firm idea of what I wanted to do. Despite doing forensic science, I quickly realized that a career in that field just wouldn't suit me. Because I think, even though it seems very glamorous almost, that's the whole CSI thing.
Yeah, CSI.
Yeah, it's a very disconnected world. For example, if you're a fingerprint specialist, you never actually solve fingerprint-related crimes. You sit in front of a computer all day, you analyze fingerprints, you compare them from different crime scenes, and then that's the end of it. And it's the same for the CSI guys. They go in, they recover evidence, and they leave. There's none of this after drama that you get on the programs. It's very compartmentalized.
Right.
And I quickly realized that. So I left with a scientific degree anyway that allowed me to work in a laboratory immediately after university. I did that for nearly a year, actually. I stuck it out. Sorry, actually, let me fast forward before that. I actually did a completely unrelated job again. I started in recruitment.
Right.
Which is kind of the early inkling that I wanted to have some kind of independent income that I could earn more than a salary would allow me to. It appealed to me because it was commission-based, and I liked the idea of that. So I went in, did 120 phone calls a day, cold calls.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I completely started a recruitment desk from scratch, which wasn't very successful, actually. I was just putting in the numbers, and it was a tough sell because everybody else around the country is doing the same thing. So I really hated that job. So I left that for the laboratory job.
Right.
And then I kind of progressed to more entrepreneurial related things.
So when you just graduated from college, what would you say was your motivated you in making all of these decisions, like working at the recruitment company, working at the laboratory? What What really spurred you to make these decisions, and what was your thought process like?
I think general not knowing. I think even from a young age, people would ask me, what do you want to be? And I never had a definite answer. I was never someone who was called for a certain vocation, or so I thought. For example, I contemplated medicine and all kinds of things.
Right.
But when it actually came to it, I didn't really have what I would call a passion for any one field. So my thought process was keep things as open-ended as possible and then see where it took me. And maybe hopefully in the future, if I prepared myself enough, I'd find that thing. I quickly realized that I just couldn't work for anyone else, for want of a better term. But in the meantime, I was looking for things that would give me some kind of a little bit of sense of freedom or appeal to my interests, at least, until I reached the point where I realized that making someone else rich, not owning your own time, working for a salary where you can basically forecast how much your life is worth based on your hourly rate. I really hated that concept. I would think, you know, is 8 hours of my day really worth, like, I don't know, maybe $150 or whatever I was earning back then? And then from that, you can forecast how much your life is worth. And that's such a depressing thought. But that led me out of that line of work then.
Right, and that's the thing. That's the thing with any type of corporate job where it's like very structured, you know, you're 9 to 5, you have a career ladder, you have different levels within the company,
right.
And there are rules and regulations about, you know, you can be up for promotion after like X amount of time at this position, and you can really start to map out your future. Mm. And I suppose that's why it's called the career ladder, because you can see every single rung of the ladder.
Yeah, one step at a time.
But I'm curious, when you mentioned that you realized that you couldn't work for somebody else, but how did you come to this realization? Was it a series of events over a long period of time, or was there one defining moment that really shook you, like you really kind of made you aware of your desire?
Yeah, it was a combination of things, actually. I've always felt a general uneasiness with being in a prescribed workplace. Maybe because a lot of the things I chose to do, there was very little creative freedom. Perhaps if I'd be given a job where I could have free rein over a project or instill some of my own thoughts, creativity into it, then maybe I would have come to this realization much later. But the jobs I had were very rigid and structured, so I always had a general feeling of dying slowly. So that really always stayed with me. And it was only when I started reading maybe books that I started identifying with, I hate to say it, but it's so cliche, The 4-Hour Workweek, of course, and Rich Dad Poor Dad, and all those other books that just seem a natural progression for people who do what we do. Those were the slow things that just started percolating in my mind. However, I think the last salary job that I did was working in a laboratory. And I think when I was working with someone who had been doing the job for maybe 20 years, and I looked at him and I identified myself, if I just kept doing this comfortable, non-creative job, that's who I would be. And then that shook me. So that was perhaps one of the final nails in the coffin of my salary career.
Yeah, I was very much the same way, because we talked about how it's like a corporate ladder and you can see people who are in front of you. And basically what I've been told is the question you should ask yourself is like, do you want to be doing what your manager is doing, what your boss is doing, what your boss's boss is doing? And if the answer is no, then you're working towards a path that's, I don't know, it's like, what path are you working towards? It's certainly not your path.
No, it's treading water. That's all you're doing.
Yeah.
You're just earning to live and then living to earn. That's the complete cycle.
Pretty much. And when you made this realization, what did you do? Did it take long for you to hand in your resignation? Or was it something that you approached in a very strategic manner? You did research and tried to find ways in which you can switch your path into something that fulfills all your requirements and is at the same time financially sustainable?
No, I did it in bit of a ridiculous way, actually. Probably something I wouldn't recommend to anyone else, but certainly something that I found very useful. So my first business was an iPhone repair business.
Yeah.
Now, I started that. My idea was to get in other people's broken phones and make a profit on each one. However, I realized I needed a website for that. So I taught myself web development, built myself a website, but then quickly realized that nobody was coming to the website. So I lacked a whole new set of skills.
And this was while you were still working at the lab, or?
Yes, that was while I was still working at the lab. But I quit at the point where I didn't have what I would call a sustainable amount of income. So I had my savings. I was starting to make money from the iPhone repairs. I actually switched up my business model to buy broken phones from eBay, because you quickly learn to spot the ones that quickly repair and flip.
Right.
Started repairing those and almost made a refurbishment business instead of a repair business. But I was making income, but I wouldn't say enough that it would have been a sustainable career for me had I not taken other steps to generate money.
So once you started that business and you kind of ran into some roadblocks, what happened next? How did you go from iPhone repair to refurbishment to SEO? And I'm assuming there's still
They are very much related, because once I had that website, like I said earlier, I needed to get traffic. I needed to get people to it. So that's when I started really diving into the, what I would call the murky world of SEO. We'll perhaps get into that a little bit later, but I started reading forums like Black Hat World and very nice and glamorous Moz.com, which is where you mostly get white hat people. So I was basically just consuming information most hours of the day. If I was in work and I had a lot of downtime, I'd be reading forums, I'd be reading PDFs, guides, just trying to just sponge and soak it all up, you know? So that was the next progression for me, actually, was I realized the power behind controlling search engine results, because the only difference between me and a successful business where I was based at the time was the ability to get people to the website, because there's nothing to differentiate us. We both repair phones. We both have websites that look good. But the only reason they're really successful is because people know about them. And so by controlling the Google search, I just realized there was just so much power and opportunity in that across any industry.
And how did you apply what you've learned to your own business? And how did the results kind of inspire you to end up, you know, dishing that business all together and diving headfirst into running SEO for your own clients?
Yeah, so I started to do a little bit on my own website, and again, just kept reading and reading. And I quickly realized that for the knowledge I gained doing that, I could command a pretty decent fee. My first client wasn't huge by any stretch of the imagination, but yeah, I just kept going with it. And sorry, to answer your question, I suppose, how did I transition? Is that what you mean? Yeah. Once I'd reached like a satisfactory level of knowledge, I was able to realize that if I could scale the number of clients, then the earning potentials could be huge. Does that answer your question?
I find, just because you work in SEO, I think it'd be interesting to ask this.
Yeah.
How did your first clients find out about you?
Was it through
SEO? Was it through knocking on doors?
No. So very old fashioned, and an approach I would recommend to anyone starting any business is to go and do real world networking. The main rule of which for me was don't be a dick and just generally be interested in other people. So that was my approach to that. I got out, joined a networking organization, put on nice clothes again, and just shook enough hands, spoke to enough people, told them what I did. And the customers just started coming steadily from that.
Right.
Once I got that first one, I quickly got recommended to a second. Mm-hmm. I did a good job for them both, made them a lot of money. And it just grew at a nice rate from there, really. It was just all word of mouth, the old-fashioned way. In fact, I would say ranking for an SEO company is a little bit of a worthless pursuit. Unless you've got a lot of people behind you and you can spare the man hours, it's almost, you're competing for the wrong people, because the people searching for SEO, they know, how do I put it? The people I was interested in targeting is the people who didn't know where SEO was, or maybe the power of it, because then it was a complete...
Right.
The sale was me telling them about the benefits, maybe showing them some results from my clients, and really preaching about SEO. Whereas I think if you're ranking and relying on that, you're just one fish amongst many. I just want to be that one guy that they knew did SEO. or were referred to them by a friend who'd had good results with me. And yeah, you can ask almost any price that way.
Right. And the way you structure like a deal with your client is probably more or less like commission based, right? So it's like all upside and no downside is what I would imagine.
No, it's SEO as a business model is pretty attractive, which is why you get a lot of snake oil salesmen and shady people doing it, because you get paid from day one. So it's widely accepted that rankings take months. So What happens often is people will charge a monthly fee. They'll get 6 months down the line, and the client who maybe doesn't know much about SEO will be like, okay, so where are my results? What have you done for me? And they're like, well, you know, it's Google. They control their algorithm, and they come up with a whole number of excuses why nothing's been done, or there's been literally no effect. People get burned that way. In fact, some of my best and longest term clients have previously been burned by people who do just that. They come to me with a little bit of suspicion then, because anyone who does SEO is potentially a con man. When you can really be that knowledgeable, nice guy, for want of a better word, it puts that to rest. And when you deliver the results to them, then you know, those fears are gone. But yeah, it's a weird industry then.
Yeah. So in an industry where it takes 6 months for your work to bear fruit,
yeah,
how do you sell yourself to your clients, and how do you develop a strong reputation in the midst of all this chaos and snake oil salesmen?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily say it's 6 months to get results. I mean, you can do it within a month or a couple of weeks. It depends really on the competition and the search terms that your clients want to go for. But in terms of distinguishing yourself, I think the way I meet people is how I would say I've distinguished myself. When very often people, I don't know, I'm not sure how other people approach getting clients, but meeting people in person, I think, really puts them at ease. And now, fortunately, I have a lot of case studies where I can say, look, this is a success. This is the tangible money that I've made for other people. Here's maybe a 3 or 6 month contract, and here's my monthly reports. You can see exactly what I've done. These are the results I've delivered. This is how your traffic has increased, and this is how much money you've made. So I'm very upfront with my methods and the things that I deliver to clients. There's no smoke, you know. It's very transparent. That's, I think, what makes me different.
So you mentioned that you worked in your own SEO business for a few years before actually making the transition, coming to Chiang Mai. So it seems to me that you were first motivated by a desire to not work for someone else, and it wasn't really about the travel. It wasn't really about digital nomadism. But you did read books like The 4-Hour Workweek, things like that. So my question to you is, how did you eventually decide on transitioning into a digital nomadic lifestyle and incorporating more of travel into your life? Was it something that was always part of the master plan, or was it something that started entering your mind after you got your business up and running?
First and foremost, I would say I'm a businessman. So the travel was a secondary goal, aim, just something that I thought was a maybe, that'd be nice to do, but it certainly wasn't my aim. My aim was, first of all, to create my own lifestyle, to design my own destiny. That sounds very dramatic, but I think it's a nice way of putting it. But no, the travel was a secondary thing. Once I got to the stage where I built up a substantial enough amount of savings and my income was at a satisfactory level, then I thought, okay, well, what now? Can I do things a little differently? And that's when the travel came in. I'd read about it years previously in the 4-Hour Workweek and things, so I knew it was a possibility. But my aim was, first and foremost, was to keep my clients happy and build a sustainable business.
So how did you decide on Chiang Mai? Chiang Mai. Your first location.
Yeah, I think it seems to be 90% of people's first location. It's almost like the mecca for the new digital nomads, even though I wouldn't necessarily use the term digital nomad to describe myself. Chiang Mai just seemed very well covered, very well documented. I think I approached my attitude to travel in a very logical way. I wanted to go somewhere where maybe there was opportunity to meet other like-minded people who could maybe benefit my business in some way. And I realized quickly that the concentration of people was around Chiang Mai, and the transition would be very easy to make. So those, I think, were my main reasons.
Did you know anyone else who were living this type of lifestyle?
No, I completely did this in isolation. In fact, all of my friends back home, they work regular jobs. I'm probably finding what I do very strange, or some kind of holiday, I guess. Now, people, is he working? Is he on holidays? You know, it must be lovely to just be sitting in the sun all the time, which is totally not the case. Yeah, I think people back home just find it very strange. I think that's the best word to describe it. I'm a bit of an anomaly, I would say, in that respect.
And where's home for you?
Home for me is a small town in South Wales, actually, of very, very few people, in a very beautiful area of the country, very close to the sea, but also in the mountains, just the best of the Welsh countryside, I'd say.
Okay, great. And how did you tell your family that you were coming to Chiang Mai? How did everyone take this information? You kind of alluded to that, but I thought I'd just ask.
Yeah, I think I'd mentioned maybe even 9 to 12 months in advance of me coming that I was going to be making this trip. People were kind of like, oh, okay, nice. Not really thinking it's a reality because, you know, who just packs their bags and goes to Thailand and why?
Probably not common from a small town.
No, exactly. Not common in the UK at all, but proportionally. And I think, yeah, it was just met with a lot of bemusement, maybe a little bit of, yeah, he's not really going to do that. So, yeah. Okay, we'll see. But I think the realization once I finally booked those tickets, when it was real, I think then people kind of sat up and took notice a bit more because, you know, that's me in general, though. I'm not very much a talker. If I say I'm going to do something, then usually in my mind, it's already solidified and I'm going to do it. So that's the way I treat most things. If I say I'm going to do something, then I'll do it.
So now that you're in Chiang Mai, you've been here for 3 months, coming on 4 months, what were some of the expectations you had coming in, and how did those expectations play out?
My expectations of Chiang Mai, I really didn't have a lot other than knowing there was a community here that did like-minded things. In terms of how I feel about the place now, I think I really love the place, actually. I think I've reached the threshold of my time here now because I feel like I've experienced all it has to offer, and I think I'm maybe now open to go into more far-flung places simply because it's a very comfortable lifestyle here and it's very easy to stay in a bubble, and that's something I don't particularly want now. I feel like I've got all I can out of the community. Of course, there's always new people coming in, but I just feel like I'm ready to move on now. Even though I love the people here, I love the food, and I love the place, and I would recommend it to anyone to come to, especially for their first time transition. I feel like three, four months now, you're at the edge, really. You need to maybe try something else.
And just so people have a good idea of what Chiang Mai lifestyle is like, what are the types of people you've been meeting here? And has it, because you mentioned that one of the things you wanted to do coming here was to meet other people that work in similar spaces, also working on online businesses, so you could potentially find new clients. How has Chiang Mai been from a networking, from a social, even a social aspect?
It's a spectrum, actually. It's like anywhere. I think you get the best and maybe the not so great people all gathering here. I think how I like to categorize it, and it's kind of a handy categorization. There's really two kinds of people, I think, here. You get the people who I think, like myself, are looking for a community. They're looking for an advancement in what they do. They're looking for a new experience and all those positive things. But then the other side, you get the people who are maybe running from something, whether it's a circumstance at home or a responsibility or just really procrastinating real life. I think those are the two kinds of people you get. I haven't really had a negative experience with anyone here, but you just get maybe some people you want to hang around with who you know you can learn something from, and then others not so much. But that's not a negative thing about Chiang Mai. It just happens to be a very concentrated community that you experience all those things in.
Yeah, so it's like here's everything. Like, just pick and choose what you want.
Yeah.
So speaking of picking and choosing, what have been your favorite things about Chiang Mai?
For me, the food. I think anywhere I'd stay long term would have to have great food, and certainly in the area that I stay in the Neiman area. It's again a very Chiang Mai nomad remote worker cliche, but the Neiman area is really, it has everything. There's a great restaurants, great coffee, whatever you want for drinks, there's great bars, it's perfect. That's one of my favorite things, I think, about Chiang Mai, but also the people. You know, I've tried my best as well to integrate a little bit with right. Thai people doing things like Muay Thai and going to some of the night activities here that aren't remote community arranged. So yeah, the people are just, I think they're probably the friendliest I've met. In fact, I got into a scooter accident that was pretty bad, got pretty injured actually. And two Thai people, completely unconnected, stopped. One of them drove us 60 miles to a hospital, and the other guys just put our bike on the back of the pickup truck, and they just came with us the whole way, wouldn't accept any kind of compensation for fuel or anything, and just made sure we were okay, you know? And that to me was strangely a very nice experience.
That sounds crazy, because you said, what, 60 miles
yeah.
to the nearest hospital? That's...
It was over an hour.
That's a long, very, very long way.
Exactly. And these guys are on holidays, so it was a really nice thing for them to do, just take time out of their holiday and do something nice for no one, expecting nothing in return. And I think that's like a nice summary of the Thai people in general.
And based on what I remember, the trip you're going on where you had that accident, you were actually driving on scooters, going into exploring some other towns around Chiang Mai. Is that right? Was it to Pai?
Yeah, there's a beautiful place that I think everybody goes when they need a little break from Chiang Mai, when they want to get out of the city and more into the beautiful Thai countryside. Yeah, that's Pai, and I would definitely recommend it to anyone. In fact, I would recommend that trip to anyone. Just get a motorbike and do it. Don't be put off by my experience. It was just like a freak, by chance, unfortunate event. But go to Pai on a motorcycle, and don't sue me if you do crash.
And it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy to rent scooters here, right? It's like they do daily rentals.
Yeah, everything's super easy. Scooters can be rented by the day, the week, the month. There's a pretty relaxed attitude towards licensing in the sense that you don't need one, even though officially you do. Very few places will do any kind of check. They just want your money. So you can, yeah, that's the danger though, is anybody and everybody can be on a scooter. So yeah, there's
so
a lot of accidents.
If they had better enforced regulations, then you might not even... had your accent.
Well, maybe I wouldn't have been on a bike if things were more enforced, but no, I don't know about that. It's I'm a liberal, so I'm very relaxed attitude. As long as you don't hurt anyone else, I guess. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, so you've been here now for 3 months, and you've kind of enjoyed, to your point, everything that you seem that Chiang Mai has to offer. Now, looking back at the path you took to get here and the amount of time that you worked on your business before you came to Chiang Mai, what would you recommend people who are listening? Because I know we kind of talked about this off the podcast, where a lot of people kind of just quit their jobs, book a one-way ticket to Chiang Mai, and then try and figure things out from there. What would you recommend people who are thinking about living this type of lifestyle? What approach would you recommend that they take?
Just know yourself. I think that's true for anything. I think it's a very liberating thing to book a one-way ticket to Thailand. So yeah, I would say do that, but have the means to sustain yourself. Be comfortable with the lifestyle that you're going to live here, because a lot of people really struggle and they find themselves in desperate situations and staying in places they wouldn't really want to stay in because they don't have the money. So, I mean, what's wrong with working a regular job, building up a bit of income and doing things a little bit more sensibly? That being said, it appeals to my nature to really throw yourself in at the deep end. So I would say just know what you're looking for. Come with a plan, a skill that you want to get, a business you want to build, or an app. I really say if you come out here lost, then you aren't necessarily going to find yourself. You may just find yourself in a desperate situation depending on your means. So just really know yourself and what you want before you come, or have some idea of how you're going to get it.
So knowing what you do now, could you have come to Chiang Mai and started traveling a lot sooner, or did you leave at just the right time?
I think just the right time. I had some stuff back home that I needed to be there for. you know, family things. And I definitely love being comfortable here because the currency arbitrage makes it that if you have means, or, you know, then you can pretty much live in a very nice, comfortable lifestyle out here based just on how much more your money's worth. So yeah, that would, I think I came at the right time, actually, for me at least anyway, just for my comfort level and my business objectives, and my income stream, I chose the right time. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So what are you looking forward to in the next 6 months to a year, like in terms of professional, personal? Because now you've pretty much validated the fact that, you know, you can live in a different part of the world and still run your businesses remotely. So what's the game plan?
The game plan for me is to move into something scalable. So SEO will scale to a certain level and you'll have certain bottlenecks depending on how you do SEO. For me, I would like a business that's a little bit more hands-off. I hesitate to say passive sometimes because that sounds like you just want to maybe sit on a beach and watch the money roll in, and that's not what I want, because I very much want something that stimulates and fulfills me. And for me at the moment, that's, I've had some success with physical products, in particular private labeling on Amazon. That's been a bit eye-opening to me how much money you can make in a very short space of time and how scalable that is. You just add another product to your range. Once you have that process nailed down, it's really appealing to me, actually.
So what's private labeling on Amazon?
Private labeling is basically where you take an item and you create a brand and you put the two together. So your branding goes on the item and then you sell that on Amazon. It differs from, say, inventing something in the sense that you're really sourcing from existing items in China that maybe are underrepresented in the US or the UK market. And you're really selling them in a better way, or you're making small improvements. But you're basically taking a product already developed and then bringing that to market in a better way, executing better, basically.
So is it Amazon FBA? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, that's the same thing. Okay. So the FBA part is how the items themselves are fulfilled. So in a nutshell, in its most simplified forms, you take a product from China, you make it your own, you ship it to a warehouse belonging to Amazon. And then they handle all the fulfillment and the actual sales channels. In fact, most of my traffic is purely from Amazon. So you really, it's just the supply chain is really what you need to worry about. And then the customer care.
So it's basically drop shipping and you're using Amazon as the storefront.
Not drop shipping, because drop shipping is a slightly different business model in that you don't buy the product until they've already sold, or at least the form of it that I'm looking at. Really, with this, the risk, there's a lot of risk. Don't get me wrong. You've got to do your diligence. Your product might not sell, at which point you bought 200 to 1,000 units of it, and then what? You're stuck with your stock. You know, it's a real business with real inventory. So make no mistake, there's risks, like suppliers going under, suppliers running away with your money, the item's being defective, the item's not arriving, falling off a ship, who knows? But no, it's a real business that has inherent risks.
So that's more of the professional side of thing, the money making. What about in terms of like the personal side of things from a travel perspective? Are you hoping to accomplish all of these things while you're still traveling, exploring different places, or do you plan on really knuckling down and focusing on these things staying in one place?
So for me right now, being on this trip at the moment with the remote trip, I'm really doing like a 6 month taster, so a city every month. So I'm enjoying that and it's perfectly fine for me for the next 6 months. But after that, my long-term goals are to really have a 6 to 12 month base at least, where I can really focus on my business and have a little bit of routine again, because both ways of life have their ups and their downs. And yeah, I think 6 months is enough traveling for me. And then my long-term goals are to really focus on a business in a single location.
And can you talk a little bit about what you just mentioned on the pros and cons between, you know, this more nomadic lifestyle where you're traveling 1 month in a different place versus, you know, what's called slow travel, where you give yourself, you know, 6 to 12 months to spend in one location?
Yeah, I mean, I guess prior to this trip, I did, my first thing was slow travel, which was Chiang Mai, which was the initial 3 months. I really enjoyed that because you can really get to know people a lot more. When you meet other people who are out here for a long period of time, you form closer relationships with them. You get a sense of stability. And that's the upside there, really, is I think you get to know a place more in a different way. The extreme, of course, the polar opposite of that is going for like a holiday somewhere where you rush around all the tourist sites and you have no downtime and you're just doing. You're never reflecting, thinking, and living. It's just you're there to accomplish goals of going to these places and that's it. Where slow travel really gives you the opportunity to do the things you want and maybe the locals would do in their everyday lives. And yeah, it's just, I'm nice. It suits my personality more. I'm a very laid back person and that's more my preferred way of traveling. But I think doing a city a month is also a really good thing for a short period of time. Because I think to taste all those cultures in such a quick succession is really an assault on the senses and who you are as a person. Because I think to fit into all these new places and to live life in all these different places, you have to be very flexible in your personality and you have to be very careful, first of all, not to stay your rigid self. You need to be open to new experiences. And I think it really help you grow as a person, especially if you really make an effort to integrate and do some of the local activities.
Any plans to go back to the UK?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, my family's there. I mean, that's the real downside to travel, is the people that you really care about and who care about you are so far away. Mm-hmm. So the UK for events like Christmas and other important things, yeah, that will always be my home. But long term, it's cold and there's a different mindset there in most places. So for me, not a long term strategy.
Okay, great. So how can people who are listening learn more about you or to, you know, drop you a like on your social media pictures?
You know, believe it or not, in my line of work, I'm not a huge social media guy, actually. But if they want to get in touch, you can go via my website, which is infocusseo.co.uk, and reach out to me there, or maybe check out one of the Nomad groups I'm in and add me on Facebook or shoot me a message, and we'll have a chat.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Really learned a lot and excited to travel with you for another like 5-6 months.
Yeah, it's been great so far and I'm looking forward to the months ahead.
And that's a wrap for my interview with Nathan. If you want to find out more about Nathan and his adventures, along with more information about everything we talked about, visit theremotelifestyle.com/24. There you'll find the show notes for this week's episode. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Remote Podcast. Be sure to leave a review of the show so that I can continue to improve it. If you liked what you heard, go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss out on an episode. If you're ready to take the leap and live the remote lifestyle, visit theremotelifestyle.com/remote to sign up for our free email course titled Become a Digital Nomad in 7 Steps, even if you have no idea where to start. The course will take you from sitting in your office wondering what to do with your life to having a plan of action to live and work remotely. So make sure you don't miss out by visiting theremotelifestyle.com/remote. That's all for now, and I'll see you in the next episode.